The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Zen Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Blue Cliff Record, Case 51. When Shui Feng was living in a hut, there were two monks who came to pay their respects. Seeing them coming, he pushed open the door of the hut with his hand, popped out, and said, "What is it?" A monk also said, "What is it?" Feng lowered his head and went back inside the hut. Later, the monk came to Yan To. To asked, "Where are you coming from?" The monk said, "I've come from Lingnan." To said, "Did you ever go to Shui Feng?" The monk said, "I went there." To said, "What did he have to say?" The monk recounted the preceding story. The monk said, "He said nothing. He lowered his head and went back inside the hut." To said, "Alas, it's too bad I didn't tell him the last word before. If I had told him, no one on earth could cope with old Shui." At the end of the summer, the monk again brought up the preceding story to ask for instruction. To said, "Why didn't you ask earlier?" The monk said, "It's not so easy to ask you about this." To said, "Though Shui Feng is born of the same lineage as me, he doesn't die in the same lineage as me. If you want to know the last word, just this is it." So when we hear these stories about the great Zen teachers of the past interacting with each other, and there's a lot of interaction in this particular story, it's very important that we not make them into figures who are not anything like us, some kind of special saintly people, wily Zen masters, whatever we might put them in to some kind of category about. We have to see that these people are just like us, just like all of us who've come to this sesshin. Just like all of us who have decided, as Michael implored us last night in his opening remarks, their whole reason for being is to wake up out of the fog or the delusion or the misunderstanding about what it means to be human. It's so important to see that we are those two monks going to visit this hermit in his hut, Shui Feng. And we're also, Shui Feng. And that we're also that teacher, Yan To, who receives the two monks and asks what's going on. And I realized when I blundered in reading it, it was partly because I had forgotten that Yan To says this. To said, "Did you ever go to Shui Feng?" And the monk said, "I went there." And To said, "What did he have to say?" The monk recounted the preceding story. And then To says again, "What did he say?" That was the part that confused me. He asked twice. What did he have to say? What did he say? What did he have to say? How did he show up? Really, what is he asking? How do you show up? One of the things about being at sesshin is that you have to constantly show up. Even if you have, in quotes, nothing to do but sit here, you have to show up in your sitting. If you notice that you're falling asleep, notice that you're falling asleep. be a sleepy Buddha, fully show up that way. If you make, in quotes, mistake, you turn left instead of turning right, you miss a bell, you do an extra bell, whatever it is, you have to show up in that too. All of it is about showing up and owning your own human beingness. These two characters are famous, Shui Feng and Yan To, in Zen circles anyway. They were Dharma brothers, we say, not biological brothers, but they studied together, just like all of us here are brothers and sisters studying in Boundless Way. They studied together under the great master Daishan. And some of you may remember, there are a number of stories about Daishan. I'm not going to tell all of them. But we encounter him, Daishan, in a lot of koans. And in this koan, there's a reference that Yan To makes to another koan, another story, that is. When Daishan, as a very old man, and he was, when he was a young man, he was quite arrogant, difficult to be around, always showing off. We say he had the stink of Zen, you know, not a normal human being, but somebody showing off a little bit about how much he knew and how much he understood about the Great Way. And then he kind of goes around to people and shows off some more. This story that I'm about to mention, and I won't go into great detail about it, is when Daishan was an old man. In fact, apparently this happened 3 years before he died, so he was quite old. And at that time, Shui Feng, who in this story is that hermit living in the hut who pops out and says, "What is it?" At that time, Shui Feng was the cook in the monastery. He was Jamie. He was in the kitchen, nourishing all of the people who were at this particular monastery, Daishan's monastery. And he was late for lunch. The rice was taking longer, you know how it is. Daishan came down with his bowls, his eating bowls in his hand, into the kitchen. And Shui Feng scolded his teacher. He said, "What are you doing here? The bell hasn't rung, the drum hasn't sounded." And this moment in this koan is a very profound moment, because what Daishan does, and I alluded to this yesterday, I think partly because I was thinking about it, he bows. He doesn't say, "Well, what do you mean? I'm the teacher and it's late. Look, look, the time is getting away from us. What are you talking about? You're a sorry excuse for a tenzo." He doesn't say any of that. He just bows. And he turns around and he goes back to his room. This upsets Shui Feng. Shui Feng, who knows what he was expecting, but he didn't get what he expected, the bow, which for us is so profound. I said last night, when someone gives you a correction or a piece of advice, you just bow and inwardly say thank you. And we know that Daishan was probably saying thank you, thank you. So different from when he was young and just thought he was God's gift. Well, not God's gift, maybe Buddha's gift to Zen. This softened human being, this person who had really seen through the ego, seen through the I, me, mine delusion. The part of us that gets reactive, that still gets reactive even all the way to the end of our lives, perhaps. But maybe we're not so trapped in that reactivity. Maybe that's the promise of Zen. Of course, we're reactive. Our brains, our mammalian brains, they react to danger. They react to threat. It's just the way it is. Who knows what that dog's barking about now? But same thing, reacting to something. And so we still react, as we say, but we are not caught in our reactivity. Daishan demonstrates this for us. He just bows. And I would say, take away that word just. He bows. He fully bows. This is how it is in our lives, too. It's not just about being at Sesshin or being in a monastery and getting helped by the tanto or the assistant tanto or one of the teachers or the samu master. This is about knowing that life continues to give us all kinds of reasons to be reactive. Some of you were lucky enough to hear Jenny give a talk about this last week. Jenny, who has had a respiratory virus for quite some time, you might hear her coughing now. This is how it is with human beings. We get sick. We find that things come upon us that we don't want. We think our relationships are meant to last forever, and then they don't. We think that our wonderful fit bodies are going to last forever. And out of that delusion, we may do all kinds of things that make life difficult for us and other people. There's a wonderful poem by Kabir. I don't know all of it, but I remember the line, "Do you think that you will escape death by eating only vegetables?" This was in the 15th century. All of us have these delusions about avoiding sickness, old age, death, being separated from our loved ones. That teaching of the five remembrances comes from the Buddha. It comes from an old sutta, originally in Pali. And we say it at every long sutra service because it's so important to remember it. One of my Dharma heirs, Bob Waldinger, says has his group do it at every sutra service, long and short, because of the importance he places on it. Do you believe this? Do you believe that someday you too will get old? Well, for some of us, too late, as David and I like to say. We are already old, but maybe some of you can't quite believe it, those of you who are in your 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, even 60s. Is it possible that I will be frail, that I will come down at the wrong time for a meal, that I will be befuddled, that I won't know what's going on, like our dear friend Deshan? And the head monk in that story talks to Shui Feng, his Dharma buddy, his Dharma brother, who's just very upset by what happened with Deshan coming down early, doesn't know what's going on, you know, has lost his faith in his teacher. What's going on? And Yanto goes along with Shui Feng's reactivity. What an amazing little piece of teaching that is. He doesn't reassure him. He doesn't go, "Oh, no, no, everything's fine." That bowing, you know, was a really cool thing that he did. He just says, "Yeah, you know what? I think our teacher has lost it. He's not what he was. He doesn't know the last word of Zen. He's really, really old, confused." And of course, word gets around to the teacher, Deshan, who hears that Yanto said that to the cook, to Shui Feng, and he asks him, "What are you talking about? Why did you say that to Shui Feng?" And in our koan study in Boundless Way, this is a very crucial point because Yanto whispers something to Deshan at that point. We have to figure out what a beloved student would say to a beloved teacher, all of them together, living together in very close quarters. I loved what Jenny said in her orientation remarks last night. It's hard to live with other people. Like, yeah, it sure is. Even one other person, even a dog or a cat, it's hard. And here are all these people 1,000 years ago bumping into each other, rubbing up against each other. My first teacher used to say, we're like rough stones in a polishing tumbler. We're always knocking up against each other. And here's an example of it. What is this last word of Zen that Yanto tells Shui Feng, the teacher doesn't know anymore? What is that? apparently later, he gives a talk, Daishan, the teacher, and Yanto praises him and says, oh great, now he's finally got the last word of Zen, but you need to understand what's going on with someone as advanced as Yanto. And after all of this story happens, Yanto and Shui Feng, after Daishan dies, they go off together. Shui Feng, of course, has had his little moments of awakening, in fact, quite a number of them. Yanto, though, is, we might say, although I'm a little bit reluctant to say this, superior to him in awakening. That is, his awakening has been bigger, more profound than Shui Feng's. And there's a sweet story about the two of them being on pilgrimage when they're a bit younger, and they've left their old teacher who had died, and they're in a little hermitage on the top of a mountain, and Zhui Feng really wants that big awakening. And so he sits in Zazen all through the day and all through the night while they're sitting in this little hermitage. But Yanto just goes to sleep. He lies down and probably snores, maybe slightly disturbing Shui Feng's Zazen. And Shui Feng yells at him. He says, what are you doing? This is important. We have to wake up to reality. We have to do Zazen. And in that story, Yanto questions him about all his other awakenings and all the different things that have happened to Shui Feng over the years. And every time Shui Feng says, well, I had this moment and I saw this and I had that happen, Yanto says, not enough. It's not enough. It's not enough. And in that dialogue, Zhui Feng does have his awakening. And then many years later, he goes off to found a monastery. Before he does that, he lives in this hermit's hut. And that's when we encounter him in this story. Yanto also founds a monastery. The two of them are teachers in their own right, but at that time, monks would wander around from teacher to teacher and test themselves against them. And in this story, two monks come to Zhui Feng, the old cook's place. And he leaps out, pops out in this translation of his hut, and he says, what is it? This is a phrase that's used especially in Korean Zen training as a fundamental koan in the way that we use the koan mu, which is also used in Korean Zen. Sometimes instead of what is it, it's who am I? These two questions are the main practice that people do. What is it? What is it? What is it? With the breath, with every being of our body, until just like with Shui Feng and Yanto in that mountain hut, we wake up to something. Then we come to our teachers and we test that awakening. And that happens over and over and over again. So here's Shui Feng popping out. What is it? And the monk does a kind of sweet thing. He says, what is it? Nice response, I guess. A little bit of a mirroring, maybe a little dangerous to copy the teacher, but boy, do people do that. I remember the few times that I sat with Sung San, who's David's teacher's teacher. He had a very strong Korean accent, and a lot of people who have studied with him adopted that Korean accent, even though they were native English speakers. Something about if you imitate the teacher, you will attain something. One of the things I love about Boundless Way is if you've ever met James Ford, you know that I'm not really like him. And we have five transmitted teachers. None of the five of us are anything like each other, except maybe in the one thing that we all hold dear, which is again what Michael talked about last night. We are devoted to awakening. We want you to wake up. I want that so much that sometimes it hurts. And when people do things that take them away from that awakening, I have to be patient and trust that everyone will ultimately recognize the truth of their being. In little ways, in big ways, we're already Buddhas. We're already awakened beings. And as all of the teachers of the past and the present, and I hope the future, keep reminding us, we just don't know that, or we just don't believe it. We think it's complicated. We think it means something. We think something's going to happen. There's going to be rainbows and unicorns and ponies, and all of our problems will be solved. No more trouble. No more sickness. No more aging. No more death. As if we could avoid being human. Deshan knew, the old teacher, that he couldn't avoid it. He must have felt death coming for him at his old age. At the time of the story about these two teachers, Xue Feng and Yanto, they're probably middle-aged at this point. They both live good, long lives, although I always thought Yanto died young, and I was corrected by looking him up. He died in his late 60s. He died during a terrible time in his country, in China. We know that right now in the world there are terrible times. And I love to go back in time in my mind and remember that these things, although they feel new, are not new. There are tyrants throughout history. There are wars and famines and terrible things happening, injustice all the time throughout human history. It must have something to do with how human beings are. Maybe it's that reactivity that we're all caught up in. And so at one of these times, there were bandits roaming China, and they were targeting Buddhists, which hasn't happened yet in this country, but who knows? A few Buddhists have been targeted so far. And so everybody left Yanto's monastery at that time, and Yanto sat by himself in the middle of his zendo, deep in zazen. Nobody else was around, and bandits came to rob him, but there was nothing of value in his monastery. And so one of the bandits got really angry and took out a knife and stabbed Yanto, who simply sat. Talk about owning your reactivity. What must it have been like? I can only imagine. And then he screamed so loud that the scream was apparently heard for 10 miles, and he died. Another 1,000 years later, one of our Japanese teachers, not our direct ancestor, but a wonderful teacher, Hakuin, we do his Song of Zazen often, he heard this story about Yanto screaming when he was attacked by the bandit. And he had the same delusion that we have now, 500, 600 years later, that if you wake up, if you have an awakening, you will no longer suffer. You will be free of aging and illness and death. You will just live your life with great wisdom and compassion and balance. Why, Hakuin asked himself as a young student, did Yanto scream that loud that it could be heard for 10 years? And in his looking into that matter, he had one of his great awakenings. Here in this little story, Yanto is decades away from that experience of dying violently. We never know what's going to happen next. Some of us have had accidents that have changed the course of our lives. Some of us have had illnesses. Some of us have had problems with people that have come unexpectedly, or maybe we already knew that they were in the works and everything changed. How do we cope with this? How do we show up in these moments? The monk comes to Yanto, and Yanto, as I've just discovered, asks him twice, what did he say? What did Xue Feng say? Well, Xue Feng didn't say anything, just like his teacher Deshan, who bowed when he was scolded by Xue Feng himself as a young cook. Xue Feng didn't say anything. And then the monk decides to stick around. Maybe he's like Hakuin, trying to understand how Yanto could have screamed at the end of his life. He doesn't get what's going on. He's puzzled. He made a nice answer to Shui Feng. He just echoed him, "What is it? What is it?" But it wasn't enough somehow. And he stays, he's intrigued, he sticks around with Yanto. And then he asks him the question. I guess here in the story, the question isn't delineated, but he asks for instruction. I can only imagine him saying, "Please teach me." I have to tell you, when somebody shows up who really wants to be taught, who doesn't already know everything there is about Zen, about being human, who has what we call an empty cup, based on another story about a Zen teacher who kept pouring tea into a student's cup because he ultimately says, "Your cup is not empty, how can I teach you?" One of the great things about Sesshin is how often we go in to meet with teachers. Doksan after Doksan after Doksan, and you sure can work hard. We all do this to hide yourself, to show up. A sort of form of defensiveness in a way. Maybe you're working on koans and you don't want to talk about how your legs are hurting or you don't know what you're doing or I don't get it. So you hide maybe in the koan you're working on. Or you come in with a prepared question, an intellectual question. "I read this book and I want to ask you about this." These are things that people do in Doksan all the time. It's like we have to do them until we see through them. And then we just come in with what we call empty hands. We come into a unique opportunity to meet another person who wants to wake up as much as you do. Another person who maybe has woken up to some extent, maybe a lot, maybe a little, but somehow their teacher decided that they know enough to guide you in the wild forests of the mind. What an opportunity! What an amazing thing. We don't know how long we have on this planet. We don't know how long we have to live. We don't know when a bandit will show up with a knife. We don't know when a virus will take us over and screw with our body. It's not up to us. We can't prevent these things from happening. We can just live in fear and hope, hope, hope that none of this happens. I still get really scared whenever I'm driving in a car, even though I think I only had one minor fender bender years ago. I don't know where that's from. I don't know why I'm so scared. The only way to meet these fears is to recognize that we're afraid. And a little bit like the compassion we bring to other people, perhaps, we bring compassion to ourselves. "I am hiding when I come into Doksan," we might realize. "I don't want to hide anymore. I'm done with it. I am so fed up. I want to wake up. And then you've got these people sitting in front of you who want that for you too and will guide you. Not in the way I'm guiding you right now, because Dharma talks, Taisho, are intended for general consumption, although I almost always hear afterwards, "Oh, are you talking to me?" And I'm sure you feel that too when you listen to not just my Dharma talks, but every Dharma talk. Every once in a while, you say, how does the teacher know what's going on? How could they say these words that come right into me, pierce my heart, pierce my belly? How is that possible? Well, it's because we do have a lot in common as human beings. But then in Doksan, you get to be met by someone who is only interested in you. And this is why the more you can show up, the better. And this lovely moment when this student asks for teaching and Yanto says, "Why didn't you ask me sooner?" I love that. Well, you know why, don't you? Because you can't do it until you can do it. You can come in and be defended for years, decades, and then suddenly, enough. and then you show up. Maybe you don't trust the teacher. That's always a possibility, so you can't do it because of that. Maybe you don't trust Zen. You think maybe there's a lot of malarkey going on here with these teachings. Maybe you don't believe in awakening. Who knows? But after a while, and Sesshin is designed to do this, those things wear away, and there's nothing left to do but fully surrender. It could happen in Zazen, it could happen in Doksan, it could happen during a talk, it could happen during a rest period, because there's nothing else to do here. Just this. In a different translation of what Yanto says to this young monk when he says, "Why didn't you ask me sooner?" And the monk says, "It's not easy to ask you." In a different translation, he says, "I didn't dare to be casual." I think that's really interesting. When I looked up some of those words, I don't understand Chinese. I don't know what he actually said, but a couple of different translators translated it differently. So I put them both together in my mind, and I thought, maybe he said, "I didn't want to take any of this for granted. I want you to know that I've come to this realization that this is so important to me." We demonstrate the importance of it by showing up like we are right now, by showing up for this sesshin, by flying over the ocean or flying over the country to get here from wherever we came, from driving, from wherever we are. We devote ourselves to getting to the place where we can have all the circumstances contribute to waking up. And then Yanto ends this story, at least the people who put the Blue Cliff Record together, who lived hundreds of years after Shui Feng and Yanto. Hundreds of years later, somebody put these together, and then about 100 years after that, somebody else wrote poetry to all kinds of commentaries about each of these. And this is our Dharma treasure. We have these collections, the Blue Cliff Record being one of them. Then later, somebody burned all the records of the Blue Cliff Record. But before that happened, it turns out Dogen found it, our Japanese ancestor. When he was in China, he found a copy, and he spent the whole last night of his stay in China copying out the Blue Cliff Record, brought that back with him. And so in Japan, there's another version of the Blue Cliff Record that has just the 100 koans. And then people found burned pages and pieces here and there and reconstructed it. So hundreds of years later, we have this book that I'm holding in my hand. A treasure of stories about people just like us. Yanto says, "Shui Feng and I were born of the same lineage." In our translation, we say we were born on the same branch, but we do not die on it. Because every single person who receives these teachings has a unique history and way of being, and these teachings blend with that and then produce new teachings. This is how Zen doesn't die out. Some people think it's already died out. I don't think so. Just looking around at all of you, just feeling your presence, I feel the aliveness of the possibility of being awake. Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable, and let's make our little half circle that we made yesterday. So we're going to do a Dharma dialogue now. That means you get to come forward, although stay in your seat, and ask a question, make a comment. Could be about the talk, could be about something else that's going on. And Michael and David Roshi and I will do our best to respond to you. Starting with Ray.
Thank you for your talk, Melissa. I've been meditating on mistakes and making mistakes and what to do with them when I make them. I, like everyone else, like it's like honey on my tongue when I get it right or when I do something great or I get an appreciation. And I don't want to swallow the bitter pill of being wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of my strategies has been to, because of my conditioning, to toughen myself to be able to take it.
Yeah.
Right? And that when I do that, I miss the teaching, right? Which is the mistake itself meant not to, next time don't do it or don't do it again, but what is it that the teaching is telling me, the mistake is telling me about my, how my mind is working and being with someone. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you.
I think that's a wrong approach, right?
Oh, I was just thinking when he said, why didn't you ask earlier? And I'm remembering all koans and stories I've heard where someone asks the teacher and the answer is silence. Well, maybe that's why he didn't ask earlier. He knew what he was trying to get in response.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it is something to really ask a genuine question. It takes incredible courage. Because we ask a question, and most of us have some sense of the kind of answer we want, right? We don't want this kind. We don't want the silent answer. We don't want the wise guy answer. We don't want the, you know. And so we're actually quite narrow. And over time, we can begin to see how exposed we are when we truly ask. Not a small thing, especially because we've all been disappointed before. I've asked you 100 times and you don't tell me, right? But are you willing to ask one more time? Are we willing to go through that barrier knowing that we might not, in fact, we probably won't get what we want, right? Yeah, great, great courage, hard to do.
Well, and you know, if you come in, just to riff off what David said, expecting a certain answer, like silence, that would be like expecting a certain answer, like some explanation, you know, that you already know what you're going to get. And this book is full of hundred stories, actually more than that, because the commentaries tell all these stories too. And the Koan treasure is full of stories. Teachers always do something different and unexpected. It's part of that. Sometimes they're silent, you expect them to say something and they're silent. Sometimes they say weird stuff, you know, like, what is Buddha? Shit stick, one teacher says. Why did Bodhidharma come from the West? The oak tree in the garden. Like, what is going on with these answers? They are not what we're counting on. We hear them because now they're 1,500 years old, these answers. But my teacher always used to say, my first teacher, let yourself be surprised. May you be surprised. And if you are working with, I already know what's going to happen. Oh, I have to go into Dokusan, and I know what they're going to say. Look at that, just the way Ray was talking about. Look at it. Huh, that's interesting. I already know what's going to happen. I don't know what's going to happen.
And also, the narrowness of our knowing, right? So we say, oh, I know he's not going to say it. He's going to be silent, and he's silent. We have a narrow idea of what that silence means to us.
Mm-hmm.
That silence might be the most profound thing in the world, and yet we see it as a rebuke, maybe.
Thank you. mudra.
Thank you for your talk. It was just so tough, right? Yanto screamed. And why did he not leave the temple when he could have? Mm-hmm. Why did he just stay there and...
Thank you for that response. I feel that way too, you know, and I feel it now. Like, I look back in history and I think people made all kinds of decisions to protect themselves when there were autocrats running countries. Mm-hmm. And some of them made the mistake of staying, and some of them made the mistake of going. Mm-hmm. We don't know. We don't know what to do. We can't predict the future. And it's, I mean, I love being part of this Sangha because I feel like we can be awake to that. The dangers. Right now, I know this, people are being arrested, put in prison for nothing except that they didn't have the right paperwork. So that sounds familiar. There was no paperwork maybe in Yantos, China, but it was bad. It was bad. So here we are. Here we are. Yeah. Don't make up a story about what happened to Yanto and then set it aside. Let the feeling that you're feeling be your teacher here. And that's what Hakuin did. He just didn't get it. Why? And thank goodness, because now we have him as a teacher. So thank you. Thank you, Yanto.
And this is the invitation to all of us to stay in the temple right now. And what will happen if you stay in the temple? You will be run through, right? We are headed toward death, but dying as soon as possible, as often as possible, and not a poetic thing when we feel that as we are sitting. This dying that is required, the dying so that we can live, so that the only door is directly through the door of fear and terror and unknowing. This is the Dharma gate. We are invited to not leave.
I meant to say this earlier, you know, I was so taken with the story of Hakuin hearing about Yanto and finally finding out what, who knows what actually happened, but that's the story anyway, that the word for Dharma talk is Teisho, and that means, in Japanese, a demonstration of the shout. And I always took that to mean there's a, in the Linji tradition, which is, you know, part of our heritage too through the Korean line, and this is a Linji collection. By the way, the Blue Cliff Record. There's this shout, Kats. It's spelled K-A-T-S-U, which is pronounced Kats in Japanese. But I wonder, you know, when that shout comes forward, the shout of Yanto's great shout, this is not a Dharma talk, right? This is, here it goes, guys. This is all I got. And this is what we work with. This is why we always say, it's not a sermon, it's not a lecture, even though I had a lot of factoids that I threw at you, I think. It's not about that. It's a demonstration of the shout. Whose shout? Thank you for your demonstration. Now, Rich?
I love what you said about, you know, sitting here feeling... You were talking about, everybody's talking about mistakes, and I'm thinking about, oh my God, I did such a great job as coffee master, and then, you know, forms and mistakes, and feeling bored, and then when you responded to Madhu about how nobody knows, just like, wow, what's... It's just like, it's so true. It takes a lot of courage for, there are people who say that, but then a lot of people who get paid to traditions.
I just got lost.
Huh?
I just,
a lot of people say what's going to happen.
Oh,
they get
yes.
paid to make predictions.
I see.
Just
yeah.
really want to know. You know, I'm an accountant. I would want to know. So
right.
this has been building for years, and it's like, we don't know. And like you said, what's the right action? Lots of possibilities. Just do we just try our best and go with our heart. That's, you know.
And what is a mistake, right? So we have this idea that this solid thing called a mistake will exist through space and time forever.
Mm.
Maybe it's a mistake in one moment and a blessing in the next.
Right.
And if you're not open to this, you won't see it.
And also mistakes in Zen, you know, they're all made up, like right and wrong. You know, don't do that, do this. If you go anywhere in the world and go to another Zen place, different forms, different attitudes even, different ways of talking about the Dharma.
I know, that's what got me in trouble here. I'm just joking.
No, you're in big trouble. Yes. You have never gotten out of it, I hope.
It's too late.
Too late, right? Yeah, Esther.
Yes, so there's something about the delusive certainty that we can have about what something means or is or what we are or what's going on that arises in those moments of identifying. So this is going on or that should... And this... sensing, this waking up, sensing, not knowing that at all, like not having any idea of really what's going on in that moment, and training in, you know, that. how could we know what is going on? How could I know what's going on? But we term it something, and then suffering. And confusion, and out of the moment in some way, instead of staying right there, being like, oh, what? Or, like, before thought or opinion.
And to be present to this delusive certainty, to become intimate with it. To befriend it in some way. I mean, that in some ways the defensiveness and delusive certainty is a signpost. Oh, here the self is arising, because a lot of us think, well, I'm not that reactive. You know, people around me are, but I'm really. And yet this arises, and it is the opportunity when we come out of hiding, whether we think we should or not. It's like, oh my goodness, oh my goodness, and that oh my goodness we can train, and oh my goodness practice. Me too, defensive, scared, like everyone else. And I will not leave the temple. I will not leave this moment. I will not abandon myself. Yeah.
Yeah, Dave.
thanks for the talk. It was really touched by the part where the monk stays for the summer, and then the teacher says, like, why didn't you ask me before? It's like so kind, it's like this gentle kind of...
Can you guys hear?
Barely.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, I was just saying, I was touched by the part at the end where the monk stays for the summer, and the teacher says, like, why didn't you ask me before? There's like this kindness to it. There's like an intimacy between that interaction, I think. And so when you were talking, I thought about this monk staying and what you said about coming with like the glass empty, and so I thought about, okay, like what is it like when the glass is empty and when it's full? Because for me, it's both. Like it goes. Sometimes I catch myself being like, oh, I know this, and sometimes I really don't.
No matter.
Sometimes I really don't know. So I guess my question is, for me, it feels like a dynamic process of the glass filling and emptying, and it's kind of this like required effort to maintain, to keep emptying it. And I think this has kind of arisen before, but this hiding or this glass full kind of a thing where there isn't room to learn, there isn't room for receiving. Sometimes I think, like, how does one know for sure if it's full or not, right? And how, because you can't know what you don't know. So if you can think that it's empty, but is it really empty? So how, this is kind of this thing, is like, if you become aware of something that you're doing, that then you're aware of it. But if you're not, it's like the things that, the blind spots, like, so I often think about, what are all these blind spots that I don't, and sometimes people will tell me, and that's a gift. But when they don't tell you, like, how do you find your own blind spot? It's kind of awkward.
Well, and this is, you know, the design of Zen practice is that there's somebody there to point out your blind spots. Mm-hmm. Now, they also might be wrong, but, you know, at least you're getting feedback, right? Mm-hmm. You don't have to be lost in your own delusions and your delusive certainty, as Esther said. Because we all have delusive certainty. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't know how we're coming off. Mm-hmm. There's how we're coming off and how we feel we're coming off. Mm-hmm. And for some people, there's a huge gap between those two. Mm-hmm. What we're trying to do is narrow that gap so we're more embodied. We know more, right, mm-hmm. how we are in the world. And I've been thinking about this too. I'm thinking about this koan a lot since we chose it, whenever that was, Tuesday. Was it Tuesday? I don't know. This coming in, this exposure, this, and Yanto's exposure in the empty temple, in the empty monastery, so he can be killed, you know, by the bandit. The exposure to many of us feels like death. And so, you know, what's going to happen if I get exposed? And what is going to happen? And I used to reassure, oh, you're not going to die. But actually, I don't know. Maybe you'll die. You'll just go, too much for me. Glunk. That's never happened in Doksan yet. But I could see it happening because we're holding on so tight to the sense of who we think we are. And so a compliment all through the Blue Cliff Record, many commentaries say, fully exposed about a teacher or a student. And what is it, if we're really fully exposed, what is that like? You know, it feels so scary, dangerous. All of our hackles rise up, maybe. But we're practicing again and again, like anybody who's raised their hand for the Dharma Dialogue. Some of you give talks, some of you are teachers. There's always an opportunity to be fully exposed and to meet that moment. And I do think something dies in those moments.
For me, this why didn't you ask me about it before isn't an inquisition, it's an invitation. Mm-hmm. But come forward. He's not looking to grill him. Mm-hmm. Why didn't you ask me? He's mm-hmm. looking for him to step forward and expose himself. And then we get to see whether the carpet's half full, empty, or three quarters, or whatever.
Thanks. Tom?
Yes. This is really tricky stuff we're doing here. So as you were giving your talk and talking about coming to Doksan or wherever and hiding. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that's really been very helpful, I believe, in this practice as the way it's been taught here, is I'm learning to really allow myself to be who I am without condemnation. And I've spent so much of my life feeling horrible about myself. So, and that's, it's a beautiful thing to feel that love in here. However, I don't want to not have that love feeling.
Say it again. I don't want to have
that,
what?
That feeling okay is so precious to me, I don't want to take it away. So there's the hiding. I mean,
I see.
So I'm not sure I'm doing anything wrong. I mean, you know, by this hiding, but it really occurred to me as you were talking. Yes, I am presenting something, in a way trying it on. It's true, I am a loving guy. You know, I mean, all of this is true, and yet I feel as if, yes, I'm hiding. So I don't know what to do, where to go with this, but I just want to say that just came to light as, in a way, I am hiding. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to hide. Okay? So I don't, we'll see what happens. I can.
Yeah, I appreciate your confusion, mm-hmm. because I think if you think you've figured it out, okay, I just do this and they do that, or, you know, because there is, as Dave was reminding us, we are blind. It's not something that can be cured. It's being human. So I think this attitude of wondering, of not knowing, it's all an experiment. Sometimes we can think we're quite open and then something happens and we realize, oh no, I was running my thing. And other times we think we're totally lost and we might realize we're all fully exposed all the time. Right? As Michael was saying, it's not like a mistake is not a thing. A cup, empty cup, full cup. We're talking about things, and life is not a thing. The Dharma is not a thing. It's much more mysterious and ever unfolding. However far we go, we're just beginning. We're all beginners.
Mm. And I think you're pointing to something really important too, how much we value the defenses that we've created to protect our tenderness. Right, it's for good reasons to survive, to grow up, to be human. It's hard. I don't know anybody who doesn't do what you're describing, and it's layers of these things. Mm. I really want to be open. We don't know what that means. It just sounds good, and I want to protect myself. We don't even know what that means, but we keep encountering these forces. And it's the encounter. It's not the thing that we encounter. That's what we're practicing. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah, Deb.
What came up for me was...
Can you hear Deb?
That line about the last word, and if I forget the name, if they knew the last word, you know, no one would be able to be better than them or whatever. And somehow, like, death has been coming up lately for me. And I'm like, oh, there's all these stories about the masters and their last word. And one, I don't know, it just was like, what is the last word? What is, like, so important about the last word? And in this koan, it's just this. It feels like it's always just this.
Well, and you know, just like when people ask, what is Buddha, or why did Bodhidharma come from the West, and there's all these different ways of responding, every Zen story I've heard about the final words is different. People say different things. Two of my favorites are Roshi Taji, a 19th century Japanese teacher who asked for a special cream puff. and he bit into it, and his last words were, oh, this is delicious. And then another teacher, I can't remember who this was, whose last words were, it hurts, it hurts. Mm-hmm. Right, and everything in between. So, asking what is the last word of Zen, if you go back to the Daishan and Yanto, mm-hmm. and Shuifeng's story, that story, he doesn't have the last word. Well, wait a minute. What is he talking about? What kind of a thing is that to say about anybody? Right? Yeah. And so there's a joke in that that gets repeated in this koan. Hmm. Right? Oh, now, you know, if only I told him what the last word was. Darn it! and what is the last word? It's only just this. Well, it could have been my, this cake is delicious. It doesn't matter. Mm. But thinking that, I think you're onto something. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe Matt, last one.
Yeah, this whole thing about, you know, in the context of coming into Dokusan, but also just coming forward and asking a question, that feels so hard. I think sometimes I appreciate what Esther said, and sometimes I feel like it's delusive uncertainty. I don't know anything.
Yeah.
I have nothing to give.
Yeah.
You know, I have no genuine. You know, it's all hiding is all it is, and I can't cut through it. I can't see it. And then what do I bring? You know. And sometimes, you know, there is that. That opening, as you say, but it's, I guess it's not an engineering project I can master. You know? It's not, I mean, I think that's kind of part of me wants to approach it that way.
Yeah.
Like, okay, let me figure out the steps.
Well, and I love the delusive uncertainty that we can be quite attached to being the one who can't do it. Oh, I'm hiding all the time, I'm this, I'm that. You know, as I said, and all the time, everyone sees us perfectly. And so maybe certainty, uncertainty, we can get stuck anywhere. We make it into a thing. Oh, the last word of Zen. Once I get that thing, right? And yeah, not engineering, not a thingy kind of thing we're doing here.
And we have to work with the tools we're given. So if we have engineering mind or accountant mind, like Rich was saying, then we start with that, you know, that until it works itself through and we see how useless it is. But we can't just say, I'm not going to be the person I was trained to be. That's important too, because then it's just an idea, you know. And the thing, I love what Tom says, so I don't think you used the word, but I heard delicate. It's hard to talk about this. You know, that it's like the guy says, it's hard to ask about this. You know, that I love that part of, that's another way you could look at what he says. I was trying to not be casual. You know, this is important. I wanted to ask the right question. Maybe that's what he meant. I didn't want to just take it for granted. I wanted to be a person who is not me. Mm-hmm. Oh, God, how many of us have that as a thing? I don't want to be stuck in this anymore. But in order to free ourselves, we have to feel it fully. This is how I relate to the world. And this is my doorway in. This is how it is for me. And then see that maybe there are more possibilities. I mean, I think that's what we've been pointing to. But you don't know if your glass is half empty. If your glass is full or empty. Nobody knows that. How can you know that? You only have to, it's a risk to be seen. And the first thing that gets seen is these old patterns. And they're so painful. Oh, I hate this about myself or that about myself. I mean, I can't believe that it's just you and me, Matt, who feel that way, you know. And the other piece of this too, just to fully expose myself, I've had a real problem since I was young, somehow feeling an affinity for this practice, seeing people as Buddhists. I see everybody as a Buddha, but then they try to convince me that they're not, right? You know, I was lost and confused for decades because of that. And then Zen really helped me see, actually, you're seeing something that you don't even see in yourself, or that the person in front of you doesn't see in themselves either. Mm-hmm. And just that, once you taste that, I think once I've tasted it, it's really hard to go back. It's hard to believe these stories people tell about their limitations. Oh my goodness. And it's hard to believe my own stories. Like, you know, oh, well, look at me, I'm this age and I'm this height and I blah, 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 I'm not that smart, or I couldn't do accounting or engineering, whatever it is, right? To see through these self stories, like what Michael said about how limiting these mind states are. They're so limiting. And to feel it, to feel squeezed, that's the first step. So you've got to be the engineering Buddha, fully. So, thank you all.